welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. My guest today is 20-plus year industry veteran Charlie Janik. Welcome to our podcast, Charlie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your podcast.
Yeah, and congratulations on your IPO. What an amazing story.
Yeah, we're very happy with how that has come out, yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, Arteris IP has an amazing backstory, which we've documented over the last 10 years on SemiWiki, so you can read more about it there. But first, Charlie, let me ask you, what brought you to the semiconductor industry?
It's kind of a complicated story, but I was between the first and second year of Stanford Business School. And I was the only Stanford MBA from my class to have gotten laid off for my summer job. And so I was living on a beach in Santa Cruz, and I got a call from a gentleman by the name of Jim Solomon, who said, I want to talk to you because we're trying to hire a friend of your family's, and would you please have dinner with me? So I said, sure. And we basically hit it off because Jim was a great technologist. And I, you know, he thought that I had a finance background, which of course as a first year MBA, you really don't. And so I became the employee number two of SDA at the time, and became immediately its acting chief financial officer, which was kind of laughable in hindsight. And so basically we've went through a number of trials, and SDA merged with ECAD to become Cadence. So I spent 10 years there. So it was really an accident of fate that I got into the semiconductor industry and stayed ever since.
I knew Jim Solomon as well. I started in the early 80s. We considered him one of the fathers of EDA, you know, with SDA and ECAD and of course Cadence. So that's a great story. So Charlie, let's talk about system IP. So what is system IP? How is it defined?
System IP is a set of functionalities that make all the other IP blocks in a system on chip work together. So that would include things like on-chip communication, IP deployment, packaging, data traffic optimization, quality of service implementation, power policy implementations, and et cetera. So it's all the parts that make the chip work together. And one segment of the system IP is the NoC interconnect IPs. So we actually pioneered the use of networking techniques inside semiconductor chips. So before us, you had wires with big switches called crossbars. That was the hybrid bus. And that worked quite well until about the 40 nanometer generation, and not so well afterwards. And then by 60 nanometer, you know, the networking techniques completely took over. So that's one segment. The other segment is IP deployment software. So there's a lot more IP now in a chip, hundreds of IPs in many cases. And those IPs come from a variety of sources, commercial, internally developed, they have multiple versions, and so on and so forth. And so the IP deployment software is used to package this IP. It doesn't worry about the internals, it just worries about building an integration model around the IP blocks. It's to configure the registers, the exit ports, manages high level of connectivity, allows customers to develop SoC assembly scripts at a high level. And so that's the other segment. And then the third segment is there's a number of IP blocks that are attached to the network on chip. We call this NoC interface IP. That are used to make the chip function better. And so those would be things like last level cache. We have a product there called Coder Cache. There's a memory scheduling, which controls the quality of service from the rest of the chip to the memory controller. There's obviously inter-chip links that now have a lot of attention from the industry. So those three segments make up system IP.
Oh, great. That's a great background for the next question. So moving forward, what is the technology focus for Arteris IP?
As I said, we are a pioneer of using networking techniques inside semiconductor chips. So the NoC technology, when it's implemented well, essentially conserves area, it conserves power, it allows higher data plane frequencies, allows for control of critical NETs latencies, it allows for tremendous capacities of data. One of the things when we were at Cadence, we were sort of amazed that chips were 10 million gates, and now you have NoC instances that are much bigger than 10 million gates in chips that are composed of tens of billions of transistors, right? Another one is support of automated test bench generation for more rapid verification. And what the NoC really does, it isolates the on-chip communications from the other IP blocks so that you can make changes to the IP blocks without having a tremendous impact on the NoC interconnect, and also allows you to change the NoC interconnect without really having much impact on the IP blocks that are in a chip. So you're basically isolating and partitioning the problem. So we have delivered, I think since 2014, at least one new product per year in the system IP space to make the interconnect stronger. So things like Ncore cache coherent interconnect. We introduced the AI package for machine learning interconnect, which is relatively new. The machine learning data traffic actually has its own specific requirements. We shipped resilience for automotive and other mission critical SoCs. We shipped something called Piano, which is for physical awareness to estimate physical constraints, those kinds of things. So and of course, Coder Cache, the last level cache. So one product per year. And, sort of looking on in the future and actually near future, one of the things that the industry is struggling with is there's actually a big shortage of qualified interconnect engineers. And so the only answer there, the schools really aren't, there's no curriculum that I'm aware of, which is sort of SoC assembly, SoC integration in the schools, right? So the only answer is automation. And so when Arteris came into the market, we essentially wound up taking the time that it took to do an interconnect instance from tens of days down to single days. And now we need to take it down to hours. And so that's one focus. Another focus is that in the IP deployment area is as there's more companies doing semiconductors, lots of system houses, they only do small pieces of the semiconductor development, actually, and they have lots of contractors, layout contractors, IP contractors, package contractors, packaging houses, those kinds of things. And how do you manage all that stuff coming back to the original company in a form that's easy and rapid to turn into an SoC? So we're a big proponent of the IP Exact standard. We've been supporting it for a number of years in our IPD subsidiary. And so there's a kind of a more capable IP Exact standard coming called IP Exact 2022, which captures many more parameters for IP deployment. And so this is an area that we're going to support as rapidly as we can. So it's a never ending stream of solutions against ever rising set of complexities.
Yeah, it seems to be a perfect storm for you guys right now because so many systems companies are doing their SoCs now. In fact, the automotive guys definitely are jumping on board, especially with all the shortages they've experienced. So it should be an interesting few years for you. But can you go into a little more detail of why complex SoCs need Arteris IP interconnect?
Yeah. Again, it's down to the complexity of these chips, right? So when we started, what we delivered was a non-coherent interconnect, and that's all there was. And in fact, the chips, when I started with the company, were basically one processor, two channels of memory, and a couple of IOs, and you didn't really need a network on chip. But now the chips are of frightening complexity. You have multi-core processor subsystems. You now have islands of cache coherency outside of the processor subsystem. You have hierarchies. You have hierarchy of caches, right? So people are architecting which data stays on chip and which one goes off chip to the DRAM. You have sometimes 8 channels of memory, right? So these things are very, very complex. And you have machine learning sections. And now chiplets are starting to come into the mainstream, where people are starting to try to make multiple dies work together from a system IP perspective, right? So this complexity results in just much greater use of system IP. And there are some chips kind of on the leading edge so far, but there's many, we got to be many more of them that kind of are defined by what the system IP is able to do rather than by what the processor is able to do or what the memory is able to do.
Interesting. You know, when you guys acquired Magillem, who was another SemiWiki partner, I was a little caught off guard. Can you talk a little bit about that? You know, how has the acquisition of Magillem influenced the next generation of technology you guys are working on?
Yeah, I mean, we were talking to Magillem for a couple of years, that has been, I would say, a very pleasant surprise. It turns out that the IP deployment issue is starting to become much more severe than before. So Magillem, essentially in the early days, used to compete against an Excel spreadsheet, right? You basically had IPA with a port Y going to IPB with a port Z, right? But now that you have this tremendous complexity, you really need a full suite of relatively sophisticated software to allow companies to deploy their digital IP libraries, particularly when you're doing multiple projects, and do that efficiently and quickly. And so what the Magillem software does, it essentially treats the communication subsystem, which is the NOC, as just another IP. So to them, we will just look like another IP. And it also makes the other IP blocks easier to integrate to the network on chip. So the two things are very, very synergistic. And we're going to start to leverage both capabilities pretty much together as we sort of evolve our product line, because they're both useful, but they're very, very useful together.
That makes complete sense. So talk about the current landscape. What differentiates Arteris IP from the others? I mean, I'm not even sure if you have competitors, but what differentiates you from the alternatives?
So, the competitive situation is very favorable. I mean, what I tell people is I think Arteris is one of the luckiest companies in the world, right? So a lot of our smaller competitors have been acquired by larger technology companies, all right? Intel bought NetSpeed, Facebook bought Sonics, Google bought Provino. So it's pretty much us and ARM in the commercial system ISP space. And we've had a pretty good relationship with ARM because we actually accelerate the deployment of ARM processors in a sort of a heterogeneous type situation. So we've had a positive relationship with ARM. And about 80% of our customers use ARM processors. So it's been a kind of a synergistic relationship. The biggest competitor though is not ARM. It's the internal, the internal interconnect teams, right? There's still, if you look at the market, you estimate that the just the interconnect piece of system IP is about 600 million, roughly, and the commercial part of it is only about 130 million, with between Arteris, ARM, and some other odds and ends. And so there's about 470 million in our estimate of internal interconnect development. And so that's kind of the main competition. But we think that the system IP problem is becoming very complex and very expensive to resolve. and we know this because we're spending a lot of money on R&D. And it's also risky development in some sense, because if you don't have a system IP solution internally that actually works, you're actually blocking the flow of your chips to the market, right? So we think that over the next, 5 years, this market is going to go mostly commercial, just like the EDA tools went commercial, and just like the processor IP went commercial when they got complex enough.
Yeah, I agree completely. So what are the main targets you're looking at today, the target markets?
So we're useful for every part of every SoC. I mean, if the chip can't communicate, it's not a chip, right? So, however, we're focused on the highest growth segments of the SoC industry, and those are essentially automotive. They are machine learning, and they are 5G wireless. And so, in the automotive space, we've targeted this since I think 2010, 2011, because we saw the smartphone market consolidating fairly rapidly. We now have something like 38 automotive customers, and I think we're in something like 70 to 80% of all ADAS projects that are out there. These are the automated driving machine learning chips that actually allow the car to make a decision where it switches lanes and when it brakes and that kind of thing. And that market is going to get very, very large because there are last year, and this is data from, I think, IHS Market, there were something like six SoCs, complex SoCs in a car last year, and that's supposed to go to the average of 23 by 2026, right? And these are, at least two ADAS chips, a couple of camera chips, five combination of radar and LiDAR. There's an infotainment chip, there's a dashboard control unit, there's a bunch of modems, there's engine control and chassis control chips. So it's about, adds up to about 23. I think that number's probably going to be right, and maybe even somewhat conservative. And the number of cars is supposed to, so that's a factor of 4x growth in the next 5 years. The number of cars that are fully electronically enabled, which is level 1+, this is beyond cruise control. So this is highway type automated driving all the way to the mythical robotaxi. You wind up with going from about 1.5 to 2 million of those electronically enabled cars last year to about 62 million next in 2026. So that's a factor of 30 to 40x. So the number of the consumption of automotive semiconductors is going to go up by 130x, something like this, and to something like 1.4, 1.5 billion SoCs by 2026. So this is a very, very important market. And there's trucks, there's drones. When you look at some of those space vehicles that are coming out, those are automated too. So they're basically automated vehicles. You have all of those endpoints to be connected to the internet. So they'll be connected to data centers, cloud data centers, and there's a lot of communication that goes back between the car and the automotive data center. There will be the road infrastructure eventually becomes electronic, so the cars will be talking to the road infrastructure, and they'll be talking to each other. So the internet of cars is probably one of the sort of the biggest opportunities in tech for the next 2 to 3 decades. And you sort of look at this Tesla valuation, and people have been screaming for years that Tesla's overvalued. But to me, it's not a car company; it's an Internet of Cars company, and that makes I think a big distinction. So automotive is a big one. Machine learning is going to be everywhere, right? Machine learning essentially makes complex electronic systems much more usable. And so you have, obviously, automotive uses machine learning techniques, but you have data center inference, data center training. You have all kinds of edge applications. So that market's actually going to grow faster than automotive because machine learning is going to be everywhere. And then 5G, the story there is machine to machine communication, right? You have currently standalone systems that are essentially electromechanical that are going to control communicate the internet, and some people are saying there could be as many as a couple trillion endpoints there, right? So machine tools talking to the stock room, medical devices talking to the nursing station, wearables talking to the cloud, those kinds of things. So machine, so wireless is going to be continue to be a big market. So those three segments are what we're focused on.
Yeah, that maps up with SemiWiki. Actually, AI, ML, 5G, and automotive are the biggest sources of readership we have right now. It's just booming over the last year or so. But I think automotive is quite interesting because it's a little more personal, right? Because we all have a car and, it's something we experience every day. So just tell me a little bit about, more about your success in the automotive ADAS market.
So we focused on this market in 2011 or 2010, actually, before it was popular. And people at the time were telling me, oh, my automotive is sleepy and it's concentrated and difficult to do business with. They're not very innovative and all these things. And that has actually changed a lot because the car is going through a disruption, right? You're going through electrification. You're going through automated driving. You're going through ECU consolidation. There's new business models coming up, like ride sharing, which is no longer a new business model, but transportation as a service, car subscriptions, things like this. And so we've very early on introduced a product called Resilience, which allows the car companies to essentially be able to have the interconnect or the communication part of the chip meet a ISO 26262 requirements. So we can do ASIL-B with ECC and parity bit checking, and then ASIL-D, which is the most stringent one, and eventually everything's going to be ASIL-D, is that we duplicate the IPs that transform the signals from the IP blocks into our packet switching format. So those are duplicated, and there's a reference and a functional unit, and that there's a comparator. It compares the signals that reach the network, and when they agree, then they're allowed to go into the network. Otherwise, they're rejected. So it's false, right? So we've developed technology. We've developed. We were early to get the ISO sort of. Not certification, but at least ISO readiness kind of data and certification, and then the NoC has a lot of advantages for very complex chips, and some of these ADAS chips are exceedingly complex, and so it was a combination of technology, standards, support, and also kind of passion, right? What I want on my tombstone, written on my tombstone, there were 70-80% of all automated cars. So we're very committed to helping our customers make that happen by continuously delivering system IP technology that allows them to build these kinds of chips that are functionally safe and yet very high performance and very low power. And all these stringent requirements kind of favor system IP innovation.
Yeah, I agree. I'm looking forward to it. It's interesting that my grandchildren probably won't have to learn how to drive a car, right? So in 20 years or 10, 15 years, they'll be completely automated. But
I'm not sure about that. I mean, I can speak about this for an hour, right? I think automated driving technology is badly mismarketed because I have an automated driving car, and it is very, very useful today on the highway. The technology is fully capable of getting you on an exit ramp, allowing you to keep your hands off on a highway, and then taking you to the end of an exit ramp. But that's not what these things do yet. That is very, very viable. You then have the secondary roads with some traffic or secondary highways with multiple lanes, but traffic lights. And there, the technology also has a chance. But when you go into inner city driving, I think the only thing that can work today is geofenced automated driving, because a combination of human, pedestrian traffic, bicycles, pets, human cars in an inner city environment, I think that's going to take redesign of the cities, in my opinion. So the technology is very useful, very big business right now, but to allow your children not to know how to drive, ooh, that's going to take a while.
Yeah. Well, I happen to think in 10 to 15 years, we will be so traffic bound that automated cars will have a good chance, unless we redesign or, you know, rebuild our cities and our roadways. And if we do that, then they're going to have to be, you know, interconnected with cars and more intelligent roadways. But
think of this. I used to live in France. Arteria started as a French company. And the French have a very nice TGV system. And the TGVs were driven by drivers not too long ago. And so you needed 20 to 30 minutes of space between a train that's going at 250 miles an hour or something like this. But then they automated the system, and now they can fit a TGV with spacings of only 3 minutes between them, or 5 minutes. I don't know which one it is, but it's single digit minutes between the TGVs. So if you have cars that are reliably talking to each other based on a single standard, and they have a rationalized sensor suite and a rationalized control system, you can actually fit many more cars on the road in an automated driving scenario. You don't need three spaces between cars. You may need only a couple of feet because you have this fully reliable, functionally safe, reliable automated system. So you can fit many more cars on the street with automated driving.
I agree. So this is a good stopping point. Thank you for your time, Charlie, and thank you all for listening. And we will speak to you again next week on the Semiconductor Insiders podcast series. Have a good day.
Thank you, Daniel.
That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening, and have a great day.